This is Fresh Air. We've heard a lot about what might happen during a war in the Middle East. My guest, Daniel Pipes, has some ideas on what might happen after a war. Pipes is the director of the Foreign Policy Research Institute. He's written many books on the Middle East, including The Long Shadow, Culture and Politics in the Middle East, In the Path of God, Islam and Political Power, and Greater Syria, The History of an Ambition. Pipes has also served in the State Department. Daniel Pipes isn't sure if America has thought through what it would hope to achieve by a military victory in the Middle East.
I think it's a traditional failing of American war making, is that the actual military confrontation is the easy part, and it's turning the success on the battlefield into political victory that's tough. That's certainly the case. The most spectacular example is Vietnam. I mean, the United States won that war on the battlefield, but lost it politically. I don't know if such planning is going on or not. I'm glad I don't know, in a way, because we shouldn't know this. But I fear a bit. And so, therefore, I've been doing some thinking and some writing about it, offering some thoughts about the optimal arrangement after the shooting stops. What is it that we seek, and how do we get to it? What we seek, I think, is two things. One, an Iraq that is stable, defensible, and non-belligerent. That is to say, Iraq should remain what it is today. It should not be cut up. It should not have the capacity to invade other states, nor should it be invaded by others. It would be too weak and therefore invaded. Second, on a larger scale, I think we're interested in a balance in the Persian Gulf. There are three significant powers there: Iran, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia. And it's in our interest that none of those three predominate. If one of them does, then it could mean very, very bad consequences in terms of oil. That one state would try and control it and let it go, not let it go, the oil, depending on its own interests. When there's a balance, there's much less possibility of that threat. So we're interested in Iraq that is stable, that fits into a regional balance. And the hard part is, how do we get there?
What do you think some of the mistakes are that could be made and should be avoided?
One, perhaps the most contentious question is, what about Saddam Hussein himself? Many people feel that he should be a target of our war.
Kill him.
And while I have no problem with eliminating Saddam Hussein, I would be very reluctant to have that be a war aim. I think if we did, that would raise the stakes. Let me give a parallel. In World War II, the Allies said that they demanded unconditional surrender. Emotionally satisfying to learn that Hitler committed suicide in his bunker. But it probably extended the war by over a year. Had the Allied forces been willing to deal with the Germans, the war would have come to an end much sooner. Many lives would not have been lost. Emotionally not as satisfying. But I think probably a better order would have turned out in Europe as a result. And so I'm inclined to announce in advance that Saddam Hussein is not our target. We'd be delighted if his bodyguards shoot him or if there's a military rebellion or something else, but he is not our prey. We will deal with him if need be.
So you would be hoping that there would be some channel of communication that would remain open during a war between the United States and Iraq, to always be testing the waters to see if he was ready to surrender?
Essentially, yes. I have two imperatives. The first is that we destroy the unconventional capabilities in Iraq, that is to say, the chemical, biological, nuclear, as well as some of the long-range missiles and other programs. That's on the floor. We have to do at least that. In other words, throwing the Iraqis out of Kuwait is not enough. We also have to get rid of some of the capabilities. At the ceiling, I think we must not occupy Iraq. It would be a disaster for American troops to move into Iraq and take control of the country. The range we have to maneuver in is somewhere between destroying the unconventional capabilities and occupying the country. If that means lines of communication with Saddam, I've got no problem with that.
Do you think that our alliances will hold up after the shooting stops? Our alliances in the Middle East.
The current alliance is a pretty fragile one, with Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Syria in particular. I'm skeptical that the one with Syria will last too long. It is very tactical. Let's say short range. There are some interests we have in common, but there are many more we don't. With Egypt and Saudi Arabia, I'm more inclined to see it lasting, in part because they've existed now for some time.
My guest is Daniel Pipes, director of the Foreign Policy Research Institute. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Dan Pipes is my guest, director of the Foreign Policy Research Institute. It wasn't too long ago that Iraq was considered more of a friend and Syria more of a foe. How would you compare Hafez al-Assad of Syria to Saddam Hussein of Iraq?
Yeah, that's a nice comparison. Saddam Hussein moved into Kuwait early on August 2nd. It took him 4 hours to take Kuwait. October 13th, Hafez al-Assad moved into Beirut. It took him 3 hours. The contrast, not so much in 4 hours and 3 hours, but the fact that Saddam Hussein is now facing the forces of the world, almost, and Hafez al-Assad is facing no opposition whatsoever. And that's symbolic of the difference between them. They're similar in many ways, their aspirations, their brutality, but Hafez al-Assad is far more cunning. He's the most brilliant politician of the Middle East. He has weak resources. His base is a small one. He doesn't have oil to speak of. He doesn't have the advantages that Saddam Hussein has, but he's much craftier. He uses terrorism as an instrument of state. I mean, unlike, say, Muammar Gaddafi, who just kills. Unlike Saddam Hussein, who blunders in. I mean, it was an idiotic thing to do what he did on August 2nd, from many points of view. Hafez al-Assad is crafty. So they're similar at base, but they differ in that one is a great politician and the other is a much, much inferior politician.
Do you think Hafez al-Assad doesn't strike the dictator pose and make those, you know, those kinds of crazy statements that Saddam Hussein will make, you know, that immediately alienate people and show him to be an almost cartoon-like dictator?
Absolutely different in that sense. His speeches are far more nuanced. His policies are nuanced. His relations with the outside world are nuanced. No, he doesn't. He will never become an enemy. I mean, when we had the worst relations with him, we still had high-level people, such as the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Vernon Walters, traveling to Damascus to talk to Hafez al-Assad about the hostages that he was keeping. But he was doing it at two removed, so he could present himself in the guise of their liberator rather than their jailer. Brilliant. There's no comparison between the two on the level of politics. But ultimately, they're very similar. I have no problem working with Hafez al-Assad now, just as I had no problem working with Saddam Hussein 3 years ago. 3 years ago, the big threat of the Middle East was the Iranian one. Khomeini was alive. He had a vibrant ideology. He was threatening to overrun Iraq and thereby overrun who knows what else, remake the map of the Middle East. And Saddam Hussein, willy-nilly, was protecting our interests, status quo, commercial interests that we have, kind of keeping things more or less as they are. And so it was right to work with him. Khomeini died, the war came to an end, Khomeini died. The Iranian government is absorbed with domestic issues. Saddam invades a country. He's the aggressor. Well, he's got to be stopped now. It means a flip. Looked at minutely, there's an inconsistency. 1 year supporting Saddam, next year against him. But looked at more abstractly, there's a consistency there. We're helping the invaded. Saddam invaded Iran in 1980. We more or less helped the Iranians. The Iranians invaded Iraq in 1982. We helped Iraq. Iraq invades Kuwait. We're helping Kuwait. The Syrians come to help Kuwait. We work with the Syrians. There is a logic behind it all. And to those who criticize it, I would say, what's the alternative? We're going to work with the invaders?
So you have what you perceive to be a very pragmatic approach to which dictator you support when.
It's essentially helping the losing side. Mm-hmm. It boils down to that.
Well, do you think that President Bush shares that point of view and that lies behind his motivation now?
In one sense, yes. The problem with the U.S. policy, the only thing I really criticize, was that between the end of the war in 1988 and the invasion of Kuwait 2 years later, we kept on supporting Iraq. Even though the war was over, Saddam was not on our side in any sense anymore, and he was increasingly belligerent. We didn't seem to notice that.
Let me ask you this. If you think that the United States has been backing various dictators in the Middle East for reasons similar to the ones you expressed. Do you think it's really hypocritical of our leadership to be pointing to Saddam Hussein and talking about how Saddam Hussein has tortured his own people and so on, knowing that people we've supported in Latin America, in the Middle East, in other parts of the world have done exactly the same?
I wouldn't say it's hypocritical, but I would agree that it's not exactly consistent. It's not hypocritical in that when you get to a region like the Middle East, there are essentially just two democracies, Israel and Turkey. You can't just work with those two states. You have to work with others. Or in Latin America 10 years ago when there were essentially no democracy, you have to have working relationships. You have to have trade relationships. You have to have military security relations. So you can't have too high a standard. Otherwise, your interests suffer. You have to work with dictators, and some of those dictators will be nasty ones. Two points. One is that in terms of humanitarian concerns and human rights abuses, the United States generally has a moderating effect. I mean, you will find overall that states that are hooked up to us rather than, say, the Soviets generally perform better, come under pressure, you know, just because there are hearings in this country and there are discussions and there is the press to look at it and there's pressure on them. They don't become liberal democracies overnight, but they tend to improve. Second, we form our alliances not on the basis of humanitarian records. We form our alliances for reasons of state, for security and other interests. And that is, I think, it should be. I think, ultimately, that mix of humanitarian and national interest is the proper way to view American relations to the outside world.
Is this coming war a war you support?
Oh, sure. Support in the sense of, had I been in the Senate, would I have voted with the president? Yeah, I certainly would have. My view has been war now or war later. War now with a small bully or war later with a big bully. Now without nuclear and biological weapons and missiles that can reach Europe or maybe even us. Later, perhaps with all those capabilities. War now is better also because the alliance that's been cobbled together is unique. And at the same time, as we approach it, I'm very apprehensive. There's so many things that can go wrong. And the two biggest, I think, are the collapse of Iraq, of authority in Iraq, and the collapse of the Jordanian government. Either of those could take place, and they have terrible potential consequences. So I'm extremely apprehensive, but I think, you know, a crisis has been created, and there is really no benefit in backing out because there is very great likelihood that it'll be even worse a few years later. So better to bite the bullet, deal with it now, than put it off and have it in far more acute form in 1995.
What about the loss of life, the tens of thousands who might be killed in Americans and American allies and Iraqis as well? And what about the ecological catastrophes that might be the outcome of the war? It seems to so many people that in this day and age, although we have the most high-tech weapons we've had before, that there's something really outdated about actually following through on such a high-tech and horrible war.
No, that goes without saying that it's horrible. I don't quite understand what outdated means.
That's surely the diplomacy has to have risen to a new level as well, that surely there must be a way besides massacring people on both sides and paying this terrible cost.
Yeah. There's an assumption behind what you're saying that we're getting smarter and that I mean, just as children grow into adults and don't fight each other physically when they disagree, that so governments once reverted to physical means but now no longer need to. I don't think that's true. I think it's true with democracies. It's true that democracies don't go to war against each other, that they have other means of disputing, of educating their disputes. But it's not true among dictators. It'll never be true among dictators. And therefore, I don't think force is outdated. As for the loss of life, well, it goes without saying, that's a terrible consequence. And in particular, on the Iraqi side, it's worth noting that the Iraqi, I mean, we have nothing. I have nothing. You have nothing, I suppose, against Iraqis as such. There's no national hatred for Iraqis. In many ways, they're victims. I don't exaggerate that. There clearly is complicity, and Saddam Hussein didn't come out of nowhere. But the average Iraqi has no more responsibility for this crisis than anyone else. And that they should go through what looks to be a terrible period is a tragedy that adds to the other tragedies they've suffered from. I mean, if we were to talk about human rights in Iraq, it'd make you cry, as well as what's happened in Kuwait. So yes, from that point of view, it's a tragedy all around. But again, I support this because I think the tragedy will go on and get worse unless Saddam Hussein is dealt with now.
Dan Pipes, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Daniel Pipes is the director of the Foreign Policy Research Institute based in Philadelphia. This is Fresh Air.